You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 12th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Winthrop Professor of African-American Studies at Harvard, Walter Johnson, and the broken heart of America, St. Louis, and the violent history of the United States. Also on the program today, Fauci speaks. What does he say? We're opening up too soon. It's special election and primary day. California 25th, Wisconsin 7th, and Nebraska 2nd. Mitch McConnell wants to expand Bill Barr's surveillance powers in the Patriot Act renewal. The Supreme Court to hear key cases to determine if Donald Trump is above the law and if moral people can dictate your employment conditions. Meanwhile, Wuhan has 6 new cases. 6. So they will test 11 million people in 10 days. 11 million people in 10 days. What does the Republican Party do in the White House? Well, they're rolling out Obamagate. Not helpful in terms of testing. Lastly, Pelosi gets some progressive pushback on her boxing out Dems on CARES Act 4. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. We are here again. It's another day. We're moving forward slowly. Parts of the country are relaxing their restrictions. We are seeing infection rates go up in just about every part of the country, except for New York City, where the rate of infection is going down. Everything else just moving along as one would expect in this instance. Dr. Fauci testified to the Senate. In fact, I think he still may be doing so. Is he still testifying? They may have recessed by now. And he was testifying via Zoom, I guess it was, or some other mechanism. And here's what he had to say today.
I think we also should pay attention to that states, even if they're doing it at an appropriate pace, which many of them are and will, namely a pace that's commensurate with the dynamics of the outbreak, that they have in place already the capability that when there will be cases, there is no doubt, even under the best of circumstances, when you pull back on mitigation, you will see some cases appear. It's the ability and the capability of responding to those cases with good identification, isolation, and contact tracing will determine whether you can continue to go forward as you try to reopen America. So it's not only doing it at the appropriate time with the appropriate constraints, but having in place the capability of responding when the inevitable return of infections occur.
All right, so here's the bottom line. Here's where the Trump administration has been such a massive failure. Nothing has changed in regards to the virus. The virus remains exactly the same. The only difference that we have now between March 12th and May 12th is that much of the country is far more sensitive to what we're dealing with. And we're hoping for many in the country that they will function in a way that will mitigate the spread of the disease, at least the speed of the spread of the disease, so that we don't overcome and overwhelm our medical facilities. Now, in some parts of the country, they just don't get it, and they very well may overrun their medical facilities. But the problem is that the Trump administration has completely failed to use this time to produce tests, to develop tests, to develop a protocol, to follow a game plan. There was literally a game plan. I think it was like 70 pages. I don't think it was called game plan, but I think it was pretty close. I think it was like what to do in a pandemic that was left them. They threw it out the window, literally. I don't know if they literally threw it out the window. I think they literally just shoved it aside. And we are not in a position to trace or test. I know that they're developing these capacities. The states are, specific states. Federal government isn't. Specific states are going out and contracting different developers to develop apps. Some states may share it, others not. I know this for a fact. And it is absurd. This is what the federal government should be doing at this point. And they basically let that whole time just go away. And there's this sense amongst the administration, obviously not Fauci, but there's this sense that like this is political. Political in the sense that they can defeat or it's all perception. They really do think that the thing you don't have to fear COVID-19. What you do have to fear is fearing COVID-19. And that just doesn't work with a virus. It doesn't understand. You're not going to make it cocky and then knock it out of the box. It doesn't work that way. And so they have wasted all of this time on doing nothing. And meanwhile, in Wuhan, they have 6 new cases and they have the ability. And I understand, obviously, their system of government's a little bit different than ours, but they have the technological ability to test 11 million people over 10 days. Just they're going to outpace, they're going to lap us in terms of ability to test by a factor of, I don't even know. I can't do math that well. And the testing is relevant because you want to get a sense of where you are in the spread of the disease, of the virus, and you want to be able to trace it. And that way you can slow its, you can manage the infection rate. And you can manage maybe what parts of your population get the infection as we head to herd immunity. Because we're not going to get a vaccine before we get to herd immunity. I mean, I think it's becoming like apparent. And so you need to do this in a very controlled manner. And I think Fauci is basically saying like, we're missing the key element that we need to keep us from having to go back to where we were for 2 months. But we shall see. I don't know, folks. I did some back of the envelope. I mean, it's just basic numbers. 20%, if you assume 20% infection in New York City, for instance, at about 335,000 cases of infection, you need to have 3 times that until you get close to herd immunity. It took 60 days this time, but now we're down to 2,700 infections per day, and that's about 250 days before we get to 60%. May add another 50 days, to get to 70%, but that presumes, you know, some type of like that type of rate at 2,700. So the rest of the country is going slower, obviously, because it's not quite as dense. So we'll see. This couldn't happen. This offer couldn't be more apropos. One of today's sponsors is BetterHelp. You're giving our audience 10% off their first month when they go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist. You can do it over the phone. You can do it over chat. You can do it over video. A lot of therapists, I imagine, have long wait lists. It can take weeks or months before they see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Look, stressful times, difficult times, obviously difficult time to go out and find a therapist. IRL, I can tell you, I've been in therapy off and on for decades. I don't think that should become as a surprise to anybody, but I'm continuing my therapy remotely, and it's helpful. It's helpful. It's very important for me in my situation. And folks are isolated. Nice to have an opportunity to talk to somebody who is a professional. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, they let you switch to a new one at any time for no reason, for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They'll have therapists who are trained to deal with specialties, specific needs that you might have. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you would find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp. They have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. Also, this is also very helpful during this time. All our ads are today. What was the name of the book? Well, we got a shipment from Literati. It's the subscription book club. Makes it easy and convenient, particularly in this moment, to find unique and interesting books for your kids. They deliver great stories straight to your doorstep. Literati knows that home deliveries are going to be critical in meeting your needs during this period and in terms of dealing with educational materials. Reading books together will help create a time of adventure and bonding for your family and has real educational benefits. Kids who read books have better vocabularies. They have longer attention spans. I mean, frankly, that's basically what we're doing. I'm just encouraging Saul to read, and he read his first sort of long book the other night. Stayed up all hours of the night, but I can't even remember the one that we have that he loves from Literati that is... I don't know. It's a little kid and he's a knight. Anything that involves swords, Saul is all in on. But each Literati box contains five beautiful books based on a theme, contains exclusive original art, and a personalized note to your kid. You only keep your favorites. You send back the rest for free. Comes in a box. Easy to ship it back out. Just leave it on your stoop or your... And they pick it up and they return it. Reading with Saul has been one of the few things that I've enjoyed during this period of time, to be honest with you. And he is reading those books too. This is a great service. Great way. You're sitting there. You're looking for things for the kids to do. Reading is, this is a good time for that. And for a limited time, go to literati.com/majority for 25% off your first two orders. This is their best offer available anywhere. You have to go to it to get it. Literati, literati.com/majority for 25% off your first two orders, literati.com/majority. And lastly, Skillshare, one of our, make it possible to bring you the majority report today. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority report 8, are going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for an entire 2 months. I've talked about Skillshare a lot. I've been using it quite a bit, particularly during this time. It's an online learning community, offers thousands of classes on almost any topic you imagine. All classes are taught by experts in their field. They have classes on drawing. They have classes on painting, photography, video editing, web design. Running a small business, ukulele playing, baking bread. Almost all the classes are less than an hour long. Every class is split up into bite-sized lessons. Easy to fit Skillshare into your week, even if you have a busy schedule. I'm busy right now. And it's also very, makes it easier for like teens to absorb. And this is a good time to sit teens down. They want to watch a video. Now they can actually learn something. Skillshare has classes for every skill level. Whether you're wanting to get better at something, you have a lot of experience with, or you want to learn something new, or somewhere in between. Membership to Skillshare, less than $10 a month. It gives you access to their entire library of classes. But the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport8 are going to get a free membership for 2 whole months. Put the link in our YouTube description and in our podcast description for Skillshare and our other advertisers today. Check it out. Do yourself a favor. I am I'm not getting appreciably better at the ukulele through Skillshare, but I'm getting somewhat better. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Walter Johnson on the Broken Heart of America, St. Louis, and the Violent History of the U.S. Be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the program the Winthrop Professor of History and African-American and African Studies at Harvard, the author of The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis, and the Violent History of the United States, or U.S. Professor Walter Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with why you focus on St. Louis. I mean, I know that part of it is biographical, and part of it is captured in a quote that you would tell of a reporter in the 70s. And I'm going to butcher the quote, but it was something to the effect of St. Louis is like a Eugene O'Neill play, not necessarily typical, but certainly representative of all the dynamics that can exist in a city.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there's various ways of explaining why I came to feel that this is so important. I think that the one that you just pointed to is the one that I sort of learned as I was doing the research, which is that a lot of the things that we consider to be American history turn out to have happened in St. Louis, whether that's the Missouri Compromise, the Dred Scott decision, or the first general strike in the history of the United States, or the first general emancipation, or East St. Louis race massacre, or the major, major Supreme Court cases for housing rights, for employment rights, all came out of St. Louis, all the way up to Ferguson. And so as I started to research the history, I was struck by that. The thing that I learned in addition to that, really, is that St. Louis was the hub of the United States 19th century empire. And so hidden behind the sort of happy talk of the gate to the West and the architecture of the arch is the history of United States imperialism. And so what I came to see really is that St. Louis was exemplary of, and in fact, it was the site of the mixing together of U.S. imperialism and anti-blackness. And so that's what, you know, became the kind of defining idea behind the book.
I have become very, just as a, I guess, a little bit of a hobby, interested in Reconstruction over the past year or two. And obviously, you know, to understand where you end up in Reconstruction, you got to understand a little bit how you got into the Civil War. And what I found really fascinating about what the way that you, about this connection you found through St. Louis being the sort of the staging area for the Indian Wars, and that dynamic of removal of Native Americans carried over into their perspective towards blacks. In leading up to the Civil War. I mean, first, I guess, you know, tell us a little bit about the history of it as a staging grounds for the Indian Wars and establish that notion of a removal policy. And then I guess let's talk about how that ended up implicating the perspective towards blacks at that time, which was also, I guess, maybe counterintuitively for us today, aligned with the abolitionist movement.
Terrific. So yes, I mean, there's a lot there. Let me see if I can, you know, try and get through it without too many tangles. You know, the first thing to think about is that the St. Louis was the headquarters of the Western Department of the Army, and the Western Department of the Army from really the 1830s on was fighting Indian Wars. That's what the Army did. The Army existed to fight Indian Wars. And all of the Indian Wars in the West, and even some of the wars in the East, including the Seminole War, were staged out of or substantially supported from Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis. And so, and that, that military effort had behind it a philosophy of ethnic cleansing and genocide, with which we're familiar. The thing that struck me as I started to write about that and then write about the subsequent history was the way that ideas about ethnic cleansing, about the notion of a white man's country, Missouri and the West as a white man's country, then carried over into the way that various elites and eventually the state of Missouri tried to govern free people of color and even responded to the institution of slavery. And so what I end up arguing is that there is a strain of anti-blackness, a Western strain of anti-blackness that is removalist. So you can say what you want about Southern anti-blackness and slavery, and it was disgusting and dangerous and deadly in its own way. But it's not removalist. The entire political economy of the South in the first half of the 19th century is dependent upon the presence of enslaved people, on the presence and reproduction of black people. That's not the way that many in Missouri looked at it. So there is a struggle within the state of Missouri that is effectively a class struggle between slaveholding whites and non-slaveholding whites. And non-slaveholding whites are interested in establishing a polity that they believe will be more equal between white people by excluding, at least at the outset, free people of color. Right? That they're very, very threatened by free people of color. And so it's my argument, like, it's not only my argument, that it is that non-slave holding white Western view of the West as the white man's country that coheres into the free soil movement, into the idea that the fight with the South must be to keep slavery out of the West. The notion of keeping slavery out of the West is, again, not advocated because these people have any great deal of sympathy for African Americans, but it's because they believe that the absence of slavery will be the guarantee of white male equality. And there's a quotation in the book, I'm not going to be able to get it off the top of my head, but where a Missouri senator called H. Gratz Brown, who's one of the exemplars of this tendency in American politics, says, you know, he begins to advocate for the gradual emancipation of enslaved people in Missouri. And he says, I'm not doing this because I like black people. I hate black people just as much as you do. I'm doing this because I love white people. I love white equality. And so what I try to suggest is that Missouri points the way to a kind of a white supremacist anti-slavery that comes to define a significant part of the Republican Party and the opposition to slavery in the 1850s and even through the 60s and on.
So, and just to be clear about the sequencing, and maybe this was these things were happening simultaneously. The there was a segment of the white population that wanted essentially did not want slavery to take hold in the West because it would create wealth inequality, right? I mean, if I have a free labor force, right, I'm gonna make a lot of money, and it's gonna create a wealth inequality. It's also theoretically gonna depress my wages, you know, in some fashion. And they also did not want free black folk, just simply out of their racism or as part of obscuring the class impetus in terms of abolishing slavery.
So a lot of fear of labor competition. I think the other thing is that there is a degree of racialized class resentment. And so one of the interesting things about St. Louis is there's not a large population of free people of color, but there's a consequential population of free people of color, some of whom are quite wealthy. And so I think part of the underlying dynamic is that you have white people coming to St. Louis after the War of 1812, really beginning in large numbers around 1816, 1820. And as they get there, they encounter a kind of what I'd call Creole population, like a population of free people of color who have been there in families from the Spanish era and the French era. You know, some of these folks are, they're grocers, they are barbers, they are ministers, and some have fairly substantial wealth. And so the you know, prosperous white people stayed in Virginia, right? I mean, if you're doing well in Virginia, there's no real need for you to move to Missouri. And so it's a kind of a striving, up and coming class of people who comes to Missouri. And I think that they then encounter a set of free people of color who are, in many cases, have fairly, you know, strong social alliances with wealthy whites in St. Louis. And so that sets up a kind of a complicated dynamic of class and racial resentment that I think characterizes the period. And so then you see through the period before the Civil War in Missouri and in St. Louis, an increasingly kind of draconian set of efforts to curtail the mobility, the employability, and finally to drive out, to extraterritorialize the free colored population.
And this is a theme, this removal theme is something that sort of like is embedded in some ways in St. Louis's, I don't know, DNA, I guess, carrying forward. I mean, it's interesting because I would imagine on some level you could find an analog with the South, that the way that labor is treated today is in some ways maybe embedded in part of the DNA from the South and the way that they perceived slaves at that time. I don't know, but it's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
But
I tried having noticed it in the 19th century, it was on my mind as I went forward. And what I saw really was a kind of a succession of efforts at spatial control and expropriation. And so the way that, you know, when I looked at the East St. Louis race massacre, it certainly began as a conflict over black labor and over black men employed as strike breakers in the industrial plants in East St. Louis, particularly in the aluminum ore plant. But really what it turned into, and this has been, I think, less well treated in the existing literature, is it turned into an effort to drive black people out of East St. Louis entirely, to go into the neighborhoods and to burn down the houses. So it turned into an attack on black domestic life, on black women, on black children, on the possibility of a black future in East St. Louis. And then I follow that through the destruction for a different set of capitalist imperatives, more or less imperatives this time around real estate speculation. The destruction of a neighborhood called Mill Creek Valley, which that was torn down in 1956. It's an area of almost 500 acres. 20,000 people lived there. There were 800 institutions, business institutions, cultural institutions. And it was torn down more or less on a kind of a speculation that never came to fruition. So if you go to St. Louis today, there's still a terrific scar on the south side of the city where this neighborhood was and where very little has come back. And then, you know, I trace that forward to the Pruitt-Igoe housing project, which was blown up beginning in 1972. You know, again, another displacement that reflected a still different set of capitalist institutional imperatives, and finally out to North County, to Ferguson, where there's that population, that working class, working poor population, has found another foothold, and yet is now kind of being I argue, rendered up for a final round of extraction, a final round of profit taking based on for-profit policing and payday loans and mass incarceration.
Let's talk about blunt tools, I guess, in terms of just the destruction of these neighborhoods and violent attacks on where black folk are living in St. Louis. Talk about the degree in which St. Louis is a segregated city and segregated both in terms of you can see it in the context of race, but you can see it in all of the social, I guess, measures that we might take, demographic, class-wise, health-wise. Just give us some basic a sense of that disparity. And then I want to sort of just head into sort of the more legalistic mechanisms in which that segregation was created.
Yeah, so I mean, today, you know, people in St. Louis talk about the Del Mar Divide. And when they talk about the Del Mar Divide, they're talking about a particular east-west traffic artery that runs more or less through the middle of the street. And the idea is that everything north of Del Mar is black and everything south of Del Mar is white. Now, that's particularly south of Del Mar. That's not entirely true. But every single metric of social well-being that you can imagine, whether it's the rate of childhood asthma or the rate of broadband internet access, or whether it's income or lifespan or years in public education or vulnerability to traffic accidents or homicide or police shooting, you can track along that single line in St. Louis. And what you see north of Del Mar in North St. Louis today is, I think, you know, to most people who haven't been there is unfathomable. If you look from, you know, if you get on Google Earth right now and you look at a map of St. Louis, a photographic map of St. Louis, North St. Louis will appear to be green. And the reason that it appears to be green is because there is so much vacancy, is endemic vacancy and abandonment, and so many of the houses are torn down that the city is in many ways empty. You know, to be in North St. Louis in the middle of the afternoon, the closest analog that I have is being in some neighborhoods in New Orleans in the months after Katrina. There's a sense of emptiness. There's nobody moving. You can look for 5 blocks along a straight street and not see any motion. And so it's something that sociologists call hypersegregation, which means that somebody in North St. Louis can go, an African American in North St. Louis can go for, you know, a month without seeing a white person, right? Except for maybe a gas, you know, somebody who owns a gas station, or maybe certainly police. Right. And so it is a very, very segregated city. At the same time, you have a number of municipalities, among them 3 of the wealthiest municipalities in the entire United States, that are 95-98% white in St. Louis County. So it's a highly segregated metropolitan area. And that has everything to do with the history and with the money that people have made off of racial animosity and the kind of social distancing that goes along with whiteness.
Is the metropolitan area of St. Louis, is it particularly balkanized in terms of the way that it's organized in terms of like charters and whatnot?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's famously so. So St. Louis County, there are around 90 municipalities in St. Louis County. And I think people always point to the smallest municipality in St. Louis County is a little town called Champ that has 7 inhabitants. But it's not unusual to find a municipality of 400 or 500 people in St. Louis County. And the reason is that during the era of, I guess what you would call white flight and suburbanization, and I would want those things to be understood as processes that were subsidized by the federal government and enabled by the banks and real estate speculators. People would just set up a little town that was basically an excuse to have a zoning ordinance. And what the zoning ordinance did is it put limitations on the use of property within the city limits that would exclude, they were designed, intended, often explicit, you know, often, you know, sort of in the not nudge, nudge, wink, wink way of racial exclusion to exclude African Americans. They did so through mechanisms that also excluded working class and poor white people. So single family dwellings only, or minimum lot sizes. And so there are towns in St. Louis where you'll have a minimum lot size of an acre, right? So you're not allowed to build a house in this town unless you're building a house on an acre of land. Well, only wealthy people can do that. And so, in suburban St. Louis, people have absurdly, in some of these towns, have absurdly large yards. And so that's another artifact of the process by which the county was sort of chopped up into piecemeal municipalities that were basically excuses to have discriminatory zoning codes.
Yeah, I was just struck by the number of those municipalities within the context of a county. I mean, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I just know, like, relatively speaking, that just seems like an enormous, fivefold more than we would get in Massachusetts. And all right, so let's talk a little bit about the I think, you know, over the years, we've certainly talked about these various mechanisms in which segregation was imposed, particularly as we go from like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, well into the 50s, by you know, official means, as it were. But they all seem to have been employed significantly in St. Louis. I mean, let's talk about some of these, like, some of the covenants, and also the backstopping of mortgages for white people as opposed to black people.
Right. So St. Louis in 1916 was one of the first cities in the United States to pass a housing segregation ordinance. But there was a Supreme Court decision, the Buchanan decision in 1917, which declared that housing segregation ordinances were unconstitutional. And so the tool of the trade for real estate speculators and white separatists came to be the restrictive covenant. Now, what a restrictive covenant is it's a clause in the deed by which one person sells a house to another, or it's a sort of a neighborhood association often will have a clause written into a deed that says, well, you can buy this house now on the condition that you promise you will never sell the house to a Negro or Malay. And these kinds of restrictions were written into housing deeds all over the United States. And so, you know, in Minneapolis, you can find them. You find them all over California. You find them in St. Louis. You can find them in almost every city in the United States. And that then created a two-tier housing market in St. Louis for a long time, for basically the years between 1917 and 1947. That was the mode of segregation. At the same time, or simultaneously, in the 1930s, I think 1934, the federal government created the Federal Housing Agency, which gave out, which provided loan guarantees to prospective home buyers. But because they were providing loan guarantees, they did a risk assessment on, you know, whether or not they're guaranteeing loans that they believe are going to succeed or fail. And the way that they assessed risk was by the racial composition of the neighborhood in which the loan was being granted. And so this is where the phrase redlining comes from, is that there were certain neighborhoods that were majority black or majority non-white that were viewed as places that were dangerous to loan money for housing. So in the era of restrictive covenants, that began as a kind of a racial practice on the, a racist practice on the part of the federal government that was turbocharged by the covenants. In 1947, in a case that came from St. Louis, Shelley versus Kramer, a housing rights case, very famous housing rights case, the Supreme Court ruled that restrictive covenants were unenforceable, legally unenforceable. One interesting footnote to that is that three of the nine members of the court had to recuse themselves from the case because they themselves lived in covenanted neighborhoods, right? So after that, that's when you really reach the you really enter the era of sort of nudge nudge wink wink white supremacy in suburbanization. And this is the very moment that the federal government is beginning to imagine and then construct the interstate highway system, which really begins in St. Louis. And they're doing so partly under the guidance of a guy called Harlan Bartholomew, who was he might call him the suburbanization czar of the United States. And so Bartholomew was an urban planner, extremely influential in the history of the United States, St. Louis-based, who was obsessed with automobiles and single-family suburban housing. So St. Louis was really his laboratory. And so it's at that moment then that the practices, you know, the white flight in St. Louis really takes off to the county and is subsidized still through these unequally allocated loan guarantees from the federal government and also from the by the GI Bill, which supports loan guarantees for white, but not for black veterans generally. And so that's the era where the municipalities begin to sprout. And then even in cases where an individual African American is able to jump through all the hurdles and manage to purchase a piece of property in according, you know, with the zoning laws, then that's where the basic extra legal violent direct action vigilantism takes place. And so there are many incidents in the history of St. Louis of black people moving into a neighborhood or onto a block and having their houses vandalized, their front windows broken, you know, the air let out of their tires, crosses burned in their yard, all the things that we know happened over and over again. And so that, you know, that there's a final kind of frontier of resistance that has to do with direct action on the part of white vigilantes.
And I think there's that seems like a natural progression on some level, right? When the institutional support becomes for that type of segregation starts to wane, you know, that's what you rely on. Like, I'm not convinced that we're not seeing that writ large, frankly, in this country in many respects. Maybe it's a little more slow moving and a little bit more obscured. But let's, you know, there are some things I want to talk about in terms of the dynamic of property taxes. And it's, I think it's well known in the wake of the protests in Ferguson about how the African-American community, particularly in Ferguson, was basically used as an ATM by the municipality. And you write about how it also is not just a question of sort of control, but also a way of subsidizing, major corporations that come in and don't have to pay the property taxes that one would anticipate. And this is a way of making up for that. But what I want to do is sort of jump to what's going on today with COVID-19. I know you've written about that. And the dynamic that we're seeing with COVID-19 is, I guess, perhaps unsurprisingly, forged in these dynamics that we've been talking about. I mean, just for a moment, let's just touch on this, because like any type of crisis, it seems to me, in most instances, it begins to sort of reveal as the tide goes out, you start to see who is most vulnerable and who is whose boat is most sort of, I guess, beached, as it were.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think, you know, I was on here listening a little bit before you brought me on. And I think one of the things you said is the virus doesn't discriminate, right? The virus doesn't know the difference between African Americans and white people. But in St. Louis, in the city, you have a population that's, basically 47% black. And almost three quarters of the cases are of the documented COVID cases. And we would have to then imagine the difference in testing in the white and black communities. Three quarters of the documented cases are among African Americans. So you have a hugely disproportionate rate of viral infection in the African American community. And that is not explicable according to any kind of simple, immediate notion of white racism. It is explicable only in terms of a deep and historical notion of white racism. And so what I mean by that is that the virus itself isn't racist, but the infection rates reflect the spatial and social character of a city in which race and white supremacy have been structured into the fabric and the daily life of all of the inhabitants. And so the piece I wrote with another historian and a professor of public health at Washington University, Colin Gordon is the historian, the professor of public health is Jason Purnell, and an activist, Jamala Rogers, from St. Louis, who runs the Organization for Black Struggle, tries to document the history of spatial control and of social disinvestment in North St. Louis, including the closing of the hospital in North St. Louis, the public hospital of North St. Louis, which was a nationally renowned black hospital, Homer G. Phillips, in 1979, to help us understand the way to help us understand these racial disparities as indicative of inequality and injustice that are deeply structured into our society.
And lastly, we should just touch on Ahmaud Arbery, because this is, a fairly, I don't want to say classic case, but I mean, this is, I don't know that it's getting the same attention that it should or would, absent all the sort of news about COVID-19. But we're in a situation where the Georgia Attorney General is asking the feds to come in. My sense is that under previous administration, the feds would already be there at this juncture. But just give me your sense of something like that, particularly in the wake of what we've seen, whether it was Michael Brown, but other killings that of black folk at the hand of white folks with guns.
Well, it's a lynching, right? So a lynching is when vigilante whites take the law into their own hands and murder black people. And that's what that is. And so in that sense, it is, it's on a spectrum with, but it's a little bit different from the police murders from Tamir Rice and Michael Brown, say. It's a little bit more similar to Trayvon Martin. I think that the thing that I think most powerfully about this, and this is something that I learned from watching both of those cases, Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, is that this is something that happened, I guess, at this point, almost 3 months ago. And what I learned from that is how hard it is to bring these things to light, right? I mean, it was a very similar story in the case of Trayvon Martin where the murder happened, and it took months for, activists to gain the traction to get the murder national attention. And that seems to me to be what's happened in Georgia. And didn't happen in the case of Michael Brown because, the people were in the streets so quickly and were able to gain the attention. And so I guess what I see in those stories is what's interesting and terrifying to me about that is, first of all, to imagine that there are many stories that we don't hear about. I think that's, unarguable. And secondly, the difficulty that there is in trying to get the story out. But thirdly, then to emphasize the action, the radical truth telling that people do in order to finally get these stories out. In relationship to what we've been talking about race and space. I mean, it's a spatialized racial killing, right? The notion is that there are neighborhoods in which by design and through concerted historical action, any African American person looks out of place. And so, the first thing that I see when I see one of those cases is the evidence of history and of the successful history of white supremacy in creating an environment in which African Americans are hyper visible in most neighborhoods, most white neighborhoods of the United States.
Walter Johnson, the book is The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been energizing.
I'm glad to hear that. All right. Thanks again. All right, folks.
Okay, take care.
We will take a quick break, head into the fun half in a moment.
We have Nomiki on. We want to bring.
Oh, we do have Nomiki on. Okay, great. I should tell you that this show relies on your support to keep on trucking. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And we have a couple of people who have taken up the offer of who are going through some financial stress. They have emailed at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have patience. We will, I promise you, we will get to you. Sometimes you get a little backed up. But if you are someone who can't afford to become a member but want the extra content, by all means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. If you are someone who's been, you know, listening to the show, enjoying the show, and you are fortunate enough to be financially secure at this time and can't afford a membership, by all means, we would really appreciate the support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget also the AM Quickie. You can sign up for that at amquickie.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Don't forget, check out the Nomiki show, right? Who's what are you doing this week?
I've been giving you the things I tape this week because we're a weekly show. So on this week's show, we have a very long interview with John Nichols and candidate Samalise Lopez, who's running in the Bronx. She's an extraordinary candidate. We show her video. Her campaign ad is like AOC worthy, and her story is too.
Amazing story. I interviewed her some time back, and it really, people should check her candidacy out.
Yeah,
really,
she was homeless, and you know, her mother escaped a domestic violence situation in Puerto Rico, and you know, really worked her way up. And the strange thing is, I've actually known her for, out of all of the candidates that we've worked with, I actually knew her pretty well from activism. So it's nice to see like people you know move up, and hope, I'm really hoping that she pulls off a win, because who's to say that election's going to be like 25 candidates and
yeah,
you know, no one knows what's going to happen. It's a low turnout district in the poorest district in the country. So.
Yep. Stunning story she has. Tonight is Tuesday, so you can check out the Michael Brooks show at...
We've got Maximilian Alvarez of Working People Pod on, and Adolf Reed returns for his second interview tonight.
Ooh.
It's only his second interview?
I think maybe second live interview, I should say.
Second live interview.
Yeah.
And you can find that at patreon.com/TMBS or The Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, youtube.com/The Michael Brooks Show. Also, check out The Antifada, patreon.com/The Antifada. And there's a lot of things going on this week for The Antifada. Jamie had like three or four different things that were happening over the course of the week. But so check that out. And Matt, what are you going to be doing on Twitch today?
Yeah, one thing happening at Literary Hangover, and it's called twitch.tv/Literary Hangover. I'm currently playing Kingdom Come Deliverance, listening to some Karl Kautsky and Perry Anderson on feudalism and early communism. So check that out, folks. Subscribe, twitch.tv/Literary Hangover.
There you go. All right, quick break. We'll be right back. Fun half.
All right, one second. Oh, shit. Here we go.
I'm
still on.
Actually,
well, yes, Matt. No problem.
Hi, my mic was on.
It's still on.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
It's a good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 238.
56, 27, 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.